ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Killed with a drug overdose, then cut up and put in a wheelie bin. That is what prosecutors allege Cherie Glastonbury did to her partner, 55-year-old Geoffrey McLean. On the case of the wheelie bin murder, we'll follow the murder trial of Cherie Glastonbury and three co-accused as they defend charges relating to Geoffrey's death. Search for the Case Law podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss an episode.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. Today, I'm bringing you a story from another great new ABC podcast series. It's called The Challenger Legacy. It's a five-part series with the Science Friction podcast to mark the 40th anniversary of the Challenger disaster in 1986. The series explores not just the history of the accident and why it went so badly, but also those who knew something was wrong and tried to stop it. Fiona Pepper co-hosts the new podcast series with Dr. Karl Krujelnitsky, who was reporting on science at the time, and there are clips of him speculating about the cause of the accident in the first episode of the series, which is really fun. And Fiona joins me to talk about a very strange story they uncovered during their research. And it's the story of an astronaut who, while he was in space, decided he wasn't going to come back to Earth. G'day, Fee.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm so good. Extra good because we're talking about space and the space shuttle, and we're talking about it in the, you know, the countdown to the Artemis 2 mission, which is going to be sending astronauts back to the moon, well, around it. At some point, the way of NASA is that they tend to bump launch dates back and back and back. And that's kind of part of the story of your new series and the fact that they launched on a day that they probably shouldn't have, leading to the disaster of the Challenger exploding. Tell us a little bit more about what you're covering in this new series.
Yeah, so 28th of January 1986, it's the day that was chosen for the launch of the Challenger mission. There were other days that were scrubbed, but this one was chosen, unfortunately. 40 years on, for many people, this day is etched in their memory. It's kind of on par with, say, 9/11, because this was, of course, the day that the Teacher in Space mission launched and people all around the world were glued to their TVs. But of course, 73 seconds into that launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger, it disintegrated and it killed all seven crew, including the teacher, Krista McAuliffe. So for the Challenger Legacy, Karl and I, we look back at the details of that disaster, but we also go beyond that and we speak with the engineers who had grave concerns about that launch well before it happened, and they tried to stop it, but they weren't listened to. Interestingly, the presidential inquiry into that disaster found that a mechanical issue was as much of a cause as the organizational culture at NASA.
Yeah.
This series is really about examining that culture and asking, has anything changed? Did anything change? And as you mentioned, it's particularly relevant today with the impending Artemis II launch, where sending humans around the moon for the first time in 50 years and fingers and toes crossed that nothing goes wrong.
I really enjoy the take that you've got. I feel like there's always a temptation with us as journalists, and particularly in podcasting, where you go, let's try and identify the tiny little mistake, the tiny little thing that happened, that, you know, that happened and then that started dominoes falling and disaster was the end result of that. But we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a totally different story about something else that went wrong on the space Shuttle Challenger. So this is the one that blew up in 1986, but this story comes from a year before that, and it's not one of the steps that led up to the disaster. The end of this story isn't going to be, you know, and then they punched a hole in the O-ring that was going to, a year later, cause the explosion of the launch vehicle. But this is a story about an astronaut named Taylor Wang. Can you tell me about Taylor Wang?
Yes. So first off, Credit to the science journal Ars Technica for this one and their senior space editor, his name's Eric Berger, because it's a story that has lots of moving pieces and was only put together about a year ago. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, all credit to them. So Taylor Wang, he was the first Chinese-born person to fly into space. He was on board the Challenger a year before it disintegrated, and so that was April 1985. Mm-hmm. So Taylor wasn't a trained astronaut per se. He was what they called a payload specialist, which is someone who can't operate the shuttle but is there to complete experiments or to do a specific task.
They're an expert in one of the things that they're taking up there.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
But essentially useless when it comes to the operation of the space shuttle. So Wang had been selected to complete experiments into microgravity because he was this expert in fluid mechanics, and he was brought on the shuttle to conduct experiments using this drop dynamics module that he created to test the physical behavior of liquid drops in microgravity. Wang did get training. Of course, you're going to go get training if you're going into space, but he received nothing like, you know, the ultra competitive selection process and training that regular NASA astronauts go through.
Right. So he was basically a scientist who needed to conduct an experiment in zero gravity, and the only way to do that was to put him on the space shuttle. I presume the space shuttle was doing other things. It wasn't just taking him up there.
Yes. But he basically won like a lottery to get a spot on this mission. So, you know, and this happened quite a lot throughout the space shuttle program of sending civilians to space.
Right. Okay. And of course, you know, a year later it was a teacher that was being put on the space shuttle on the day of that disaster. So what went wrong on Taylor Wang's flight?
Okay. So it's a 7-day mission, and on the second day of this mission, Wang went to operate the drop dynamics module that he'd built to begin conducting his experiments, and it didn't work. He was very upset.
Hang on. Whoa. Did the machine not work, or did the experiment like...
Basically, he was like, there's a problem with my instrument.
Right.
And that's stopping me from conducting my experiment.
Oh, man. I only brought up a USB-C charger, and this one's it only plugs into USB-A. Ah!
Exactly.
Something
rats.
Like that.
Yeah, I'll have to save it for next time. Yes. So,
yeah, right.
As you can imagine,
next time I come up here on the space shuttle. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So he's upset about this, and he's obviously pretty cut up about it. Yeah.
Yes. He's still alive. He's in his 80s. He hasn't given a lot of interviews about this experience, but in 2002, he wrote about that experience in a Smithsonian book. And he said, "You can imagine my panic. I'd spent 5 years preparing for this one experiment. Not only that, I was the first person of Chinese descent to fly on the shuttle. You have to understand the Asian culture. You don't just represent yourself, you represent your family. I could imagine my father telling me, 'What's the matter with you? Can't you even do an experiment right?'" He was devastated.
That's a lot of pressure. He was born in China pre the Chinese Civil War and the rise of communist China. He moved with his family to Taiwan. And then he ended up in America at the JPL. So he's had an incredible life and an incredible career that's led to this point. But there would be it's not just 5 years of preparing. It's a lifetime of preparing for this incredible moment.
And so nerve-wracking. And
yeah.
I feel like he had a natural response initially. So what he immediately did was he asked the NASA flight controllers who were on the ground if he could just take a bit of time to troubleshoot the problem and fix the experiment. But within a 7-day mission, there's an extremely tight schedule. Everyone's on these 12-hour shifts. Everyone's got tasks assigned to them, and that's Wang included. And the flight controllers denied Wang permission.
Oh, okay.
Wang pushed a little further. He promised he could fix the machine, and he got another no.
All right. So he's tried pretty please.
Basically. And, you know, and speaking to the flight controllers on ground, I don't imagine it's like an easy thing to do, particularly for a payload specialist who isn't a professional astronaut. Finally, Wang's so desperate, and he said, "Hey, If you guys don't give me a chance to repair my instrument, I'm not going back.
Okay. I mean, he's essentially a passenger on this flight. He doesn't fly the thing. It's not as though he's the one who's going to, you know, take it out of orbit and bring it down to land. What does it mean I'm not going back? What choice does he have here?
Well, not a lot, but I suppose the thing is, like, these NASA controllers don't really know what that means. They haven't been put in this situation before, but it's very scary. And Wang is clearly distressed about the failure of this experiment. And, you know, this is also someone who's in the mix of these other astronauts who they didn't know very well because, you know, they haven't trained alongside him for years and years and years.
Yeah, and the astronaut training thing, they train in blocks, that, you know, small teams, they know each other incredibly well, and then they're like, okay, can you take this scientist with you? And they're like, yeah, okay, fine, that's fine. And now he's like, okay, we're staying here until my thing is fixed.
Exactly. And, you know, they didn't know what he was capable of. You know, did he have the intention of sabotaging this flight and all of the astronauts? We don't know.
Because, like, the buttons and stuff, there's no, like, door between the cockpit and where he is.
They're all in together, yes.
They're all in together, and he could, you know, grab a joystick or do something. That's scary. Okay, so what did they do about it? Like, was this a we don't negotiate with terrorists sort of a situation, or was it maybe we'll just have to deal with this dude?
I think it's a bit of column A, column B. So here's where we fall into inferences and conjectures because, you know, this happened 40 years ago and most of the people involved in that mission are now dead. But, you know, various people have spoken since about this incident. One astronaut on the flight, his name was Fred Gregory. Now, he clarified that Taylor Wang was a good crew member and a fantastic person. He says that the commander of Wang's team, his name was Bob Obermeyer, he said, Wang became completely despondent upon the failure of his experiment, and Obermeyer has spent most of the night consoling Wang about it. He recalled waking up one morning to find that the hatch of the shuttle had been covered in duct tape, something he had never seen before or associated with any sort of procedure. And then another clue as to what went on in, you know, the hours and days after this ordeal was an interview with an astronaut named Henry Hartsfield. He commanded a flight 6 months after Wang's mission, and he said, early on when we were flying payload specialists, we had one payload specialist that became obsessed with the hatch. Apparently, he said, you mean all I got to do is turn that handle and the hatch opens and all the air goes out? It was kind of scary. Why did he keep asking about that?
So, I mean, that is a terrible situation for someone with, you know, unwanted thought syndrome, sitting there in your thing being like, are you telling me that that it's a doorknob, basically, is keeping us all alive, and if one of us turns that doorknob, we all instantly die?
Oh. And he's already on the record as saying, hey, if you don't give me another chance to repair my instrument, I'm not going back. So, you know.
Okay. No, not ideal. Okay, so the rule in engineering is generally first assess your problem. Does it need to move and can't? That's WD-40 work. Is it potentially going to move and you don't want it to? That's duct tape work. So they've decided to go with the duct tape here. They do not want anybody opening the door. Mm. But there's no lock on this door. There's nothing to actually stop him from opening it.
So that's another interesting story. The reason is connected to another space program tragedy. Back in 67, Apollo 1 was planned to be, you know, the first crewed mission of the Apollo program, aka let's get man on the moon, but a launch rehearsal test, you know, ended in tragedy when a fire in the cockpit caused the death of all three crew members. One of the crucial problems found in that post-accident investigation was that the hatch was simply too difficult to open in this high-pressure environment. And, you know, basically the astronauts just couldn't get out of the cabin. So that led to a redesign of the hatch to make it more easy to open in case of fires. So that's why Taylor was like, what, I can just, like, grab onto that handle and pull it down and push the door open? Mm. Another factor is that, say you're on an aeroplane, the air pressure is so strong that opening the cabin door mid-flight is basically impossible. But when you're in orbit in this low pressure environment, the hatch is actually quite easy to open. So duct tape is probably not the worst option.
The doors on a plane also aren't locked, are they?
No.
No, they're not. Okay. So, yeah. So if you crash land, you can just open the door. Mm. And theoretically, if you were the Hulk, you could open the door during flight. But obviously, yes. The air conditions prevent you from doing it. Right. I suppose if you're the Hulk, you can open any door.
Exactly.
Okay. So they've got this guy not having a great time, really obsessed over this door. Apart from the duct tape, what were they going to do about this?
The next day after he has this depressive episode, you know, the crew members are staying up with him all night long to console him.
Please Wang, don't open the door. Please don't open the
exactly,
door.
Please
don't open
please, the door. Please, 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 please. Wang was given time to fix his module.
Oh, okay.
He must have spooked the flight controllers that much that they said, okay, okay, the schedule is busy, but will allow you to fix the fault. And true to his word, he did fix the problem and he did complete the experiment successfully. But of course, you know, in the wash up of that mission, you know, the re-entry was successful. They all landed. No one was hurt. But in the post-flight press conference, everyone was, you know,
it's going to be an awkward chat.
Yeah, everyone was still thinking about it. So let's hear a bit of Wang talking about his issues with his module.
Well, this part is actually the part that I'm starting to worry about the DDM. For those of you not aware of it, the drop dynamics module did not work when we first turned on. For some reason, we still don't know yet. It was a big disappointment to me at the time. Fortunately, there was no exit. Mine might not even come back at that time. I settled down, start to troubleshooting the system. I was able to get that same system back on track.
Fortunately, there was no exit. Okay. Interesting thing to say. So this, I would have thought, is one of those things that NASA would want to try and prevent happening in the future. You know what? It actually reminds me of, you know, they talk a lot about submariners and the incredible psychological testing that they do on people before they go, you know, particularly if you're on a nuclear submarine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they must have some way of solving this problem. Did they speak to any submariners about it? What was their solution?
I mean, it wasn't particularly subtle. In the mission that took place immediately after Wang's flight, the side hatch can be seen to have a big fat padlock added to it. One of the astronauts who was on that flight, he said, basically, it was installed when we got into orbit so that the door could not be opened from the inside and commit Arakiri, kill the whole crew, because of a concern about someone who had flown before 51G. There was a sort of suspicion, I suppose, between the professional astronauts and the payload specialists, which NASA wasn't going to give up on any time soon. So the padlock was the workaround.
Do we know if it was a combo padlock or if it was like the commander have a key?
Yeah, apparently all the professional astronauts knew the code.
Oh, okay, so it was a combo. Yeah, yeah. So the payload specialists are now locked on the thing.
Yes.
Conversely, now the astronauts hold all the power. Yeah.
Yes.
They're being
yes.
held hostage in space.
You know, astronauts were happy to use that padlock. And interestingly, here's a 95 broadcast of CBS News in America looking at the padlocks on the NASA spaceship doors.
Sources tell CBS News that the lock was added after NASA became worried about what would happen if an astronaut had a mental breakdown in space. It came up early in the shuttle program when a civilian scientist flying on a one-time basis became despondent when his experiment failed. The hatch was viewed as vulnerable.
Not all the members of the crew knew the combination.
That's true. I gave the combination to the NASA members of the crew. People that I had worked with the longest knew the best.
So you didn't feel you knew the others well enough to give them the combination to the lock?
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, that's true. So, I mean, you've got a situation now where the NASA astronauts are up there doing their job and now you've got your payload specialists are in an escape room, essentially.
Exactly. For a whole week.
For a week.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. What an interesting little human situation to get yourself into where you're up in space orbiting the Earth. You're all there being like, ah, yeah, we're a team, NASA, woohoo. Now, I'm just going to lock us all in here just in case anybody goes nuts. We want to make sure that the door is locked.
Yes.
But okay, back to work, everybody. Good job. Yes. Hope your science experiment works, dude. Okay, that's a really scary story and very interesting. So what do we learn from this?
The aim of the space shuttle program was to make space flight routine and accessible to everyone. They tried to make it sound the same as jumping on a domestic flight, except we know that it wasn't.
As you guys say, that was kind of the problem.
Exactly.
They were trying to pretend it was too easy.
Exactly. It was super routine, but then everyone said, no, these are test flights. These are test vehicles. Every time one goes up, it's an unknown quantity. And part of making spaceflight routine, what NASA did was they introduced these payload specialists. So we had people like Taylor Wang on missions. As citizen spaceflight becomes more and more common, the psychological impacts of spaceflight will become more and more relevant. And so too, I think, will be, you know, this distinction between professional astronauts and civilians, because there is this history of astronauts being concerned about whether or not they can trust these other crew members, particularly as we see more and more celebrity type crew members, politicians, famous singers, especially if something goes wrong.
But there's always duct tape.
Yes. Or remember the combination.
Yeah, remember the combination, yeah. Great story, Fiona. Well done. All 5 episodes of the show are available now?
Not quite. Episode 5 comes out tomorrow, and that's all about the Artemis mission.
Oh, fantastic. I'm fascinated by the Artemis mission.
For episode 5, we speak to an engineer. He doesn't think that Artemis 2 should leave the ground.
That's scary. I'm going to listen to that. Yeah. Fee, thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt.
That is Fiona Pepper. She is the co-host of The Challenger Legacy with Dr. Carl. To hear that series, you can follow Science Friction on ABC Listen or get it wherever you get your podcasts.